Pod. Pod. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the 22 Grand Pod podcast. In this episode, we're talking to none other than Alan McGee. During his 30 years in the music industry, Alan has been a musician, a record label owner, and a band manager, and has worked with some of the biggest names in guitar music. Alan was able to join Tom and I in lockdown from his home in London, where he'd been making the most of his daily exercise.
How are you doing, Alan? It's Tom.
Good, man. Good.
Good to hear your voice. What's going on? Whereabouts are you, anyway?
I'm in London. I'm in Tower Bridge. And
I saw you last time, yeah, around there.
Yeah. I'm still here. It's like, I've been here 7 weeks. But I kind of go for a walk, Tom, up and down, you know, the river, really. I mean, I was waiting for about 10-mile walk the day, you know.
Did you? Good. Well, you got to do it, haven't you? There's nothing else to do.
There's nothing. This could go on for a real long time, though, do you know what I mean?
I know. It's fucked, isn't it? It's a bit weird.
But, yeah, no, I know people that have had it, you know. The guitar player in the K's nearly died. He's only 25.
Really
fucking ill, man. And you know, he was in hospital. I think what the problem is, if you do think you've got it, and that's what I'd done when I didn't really know about it in December. I had no idea, you know. But I did basically stay in for a couple of weeks and I got on top of it. But the kid in the K's, because he's 25, was starting to get better, went out and then ended up in hospital. And it was touch and go. He's really shaken up with that, if I'm told, being the manager.
Yeah,
I mean?
What are you looking after then?
No, I put a single out by them. You know, I'd love to keep working with them, but I think they're going to go off to a major. Great band. Do you know them, Tom?
No, I don't think I know them.
They've got pretty big. It's not unlike the Paddingtons, massive in their home area, the Northwest. I went up to see them in January and they sold out the Ritz.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so, you know, they're at that weird place. They're going now, I think they're putting the, I'll have to move the gig in October, but they put the Academy in Manchester, which is 2,700 or 2,500, and they put that on sale. And that's almost went, but I don't think that. I mean, well, there isn't going to be any shows this year, so
yeah. Well,
God knows when they're going to do it. You know what I mean?
Were they on Soccer AM at one point, Alan?
Yeah, man, I got them on it. Yeah.
I thought something on that.
I'm good friends, guys, with the people at Soccer AM. So we've had in the last year, we've had three different bands on Soccer AM. We've had K's, Clockworks, and. And Illicit's all on Soccer AM, so it's been good.
Nice.
Yeah, Fenny seems to love that type of band as well.
Good guy.
All right, Alan, I guess to kick us off, can you give us an idea of your involvement with guitar bands during that noughties period?
I was working with Hives, Libertines. I was managing them. Hives, Libertines, Paddingtons, Special Needs, Boxer Rebellion, the others. I can't remember who else was. And then I was working with more mainstream acts like Charlatans, Mogwai. Who else was I managing? I can't remember. that sounded like the indie chart there, didn't it? That was the indie chart run.
I forget that you had Hives as well.
We broke the Hives, Cosmic Rough Riders. We had tons of these bands, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I saw when you first started Pop Turns after creation, like your idea for it was to be like purely internet driven, but you say in your book that was kind of you were before your time, and you kind of saw this age of streaming coming, which I found quite interesting.
It was too soon, guys, and also it was too idealistic by me, really, to be honest. You know, I mean, It was like, the vision was too pure. I should have really just had a cutthroat marketing person in on it, you know what I mean? It's really just me and my vision when I really should have just got... Because what happened, creation succeeded in the 90s when I started working with marketing people, do you know what I mean? And that, it was like me with the music and some amazing marketing people. And that's why we sold so many fucking records, apart from Webb Gallagher's, do you know what I mean, you know?
Yeah. Mm. And how do you... What's your opinion on streaming now? Because I was listening to Six Music today, and Tom from the band Gomez is basically like heading up this appeal to like try and get more money for bands through streaming, because he says the model's so poor for artists now. Which is that something you'd agree with?
Utterly. I mean, I think Spotify are fucking... Look, as a consumer, I think they're fucking great. I love it, right? You know, as a guy that just puts on and goes... I want to listen to the sensational Alex Harvey band, or I want to listen to the Illicits or the Paddingtons or whatever else, or I want to listen to fucking, you know, anything really. They've got everything. On that level, it's a phenomenal service, right? But the way that these streaming services, and Spotify pay more than most, it's shocking. The pay through, Tom. It's so bad. It's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. And, you know, you're getting paid something like 0.00002 pence. Do you know what I mean? I mean, somebody said that they got 25,000 streams and they got a fiver. I mean, that's just shocking. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? It just means that there's not going to be any, you know, the lack of... we've talked about the lack of like guitar bands around now, and that's got to be one of the reasons for it, I think.
Like, of course it is. Like, think about when you were with me 15, 14, 16 years ago, something like that, right?
Yeah, like, right,
yeah. We did a deal. We did a deal with a major. I can't remember what we got, dude. I'm going to assume it was 40, 50, 60 grand, something like that. It wasn't a lot of money, but
I think it was more than that for like five albums, wasn't it?
All right. But that was the first year advance of the first album advance. But it was enough to get you off the dole and make an album with Owen Morris for my sins. I put you Owen Morris, right? And and we had a little go. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, and Oasis were signed for fuck all, Tom. I signed Oasis for 40 grand. So you don't need a lot of money to launch a band if you've got the right fucking band. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's what Tom from Gomez was saying is like they're trying to get this thing called the user-centric payment system. But to get that on board, you'd need the record labels to give it the time of day. Do you see that happening?
Tell me what it is. I don't know about it.
I think basically the model at the minute is where the payment system works on people, the overall players. So essentially 70% of subscription fees are going to the top people, and it doesn't really filter down because you're not getting paid per play. So what they're saying is a system where you get paid per play. But then he's saying the problem with that is you've got record labels in the way because the major record labels control kind of what's going on. And if they don't want to listen to you, it's game over. Yeah. Yeah. So do you think the record labels will listen or not really?
The majors won't change anything. The majors. Do you know what how the money happens with Spotify? The majors use their leverage with Spotify to get shares in Spotify. So when Spotify floated for 40 billion, they all made something like, and I'm not taking the piss, 1.4 billion Sony, 1.4 billion Universal, 1.4 billion, what's the other one? Universal, Sony, BMG. And that's how they done it. You know, they use their leverage. We can give you, you know, like our acts. You'll have to pay us for our acts, but we want shares in the company. They're complicit. It's a bent game. And then also what they've done, which is kind of interesting, is they said to Spotify, and on your playlist, we have to have 80%, the three majors, of the playlist of our acts. So to make Spotify, you know, the playlists that break the bands, you know, the indies are the artists standing on their own. I've only got 20%. The other 20% for everybody's in for that 20%. The bands on the majors are getting the push, or on the 80%, they're getting guaranteed.
Yeah, and you think that guitar bands will suffer from that now, really?
But it's an interesting point. Whoever made that point, you know, you're your pal. But I think this probably is quite. I mean, because the guitar band is sort of almost the most unsexy thing at the moment in the music business. Oh, a little working class guitar band up north. When you can just have a pop star kind of kid that dresses right and got nothing to say, but the record company control them. The record company, of course, they're going to back that because it's zero hassle to them, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, just going back to that time then, Alan, it'd be remiss if we didn't ask you for your memories of the Paddingtons back in the day and how you first came across them.
I mean, it's a good book. Well, Tom, you were the first. Right, Peter Doherty used to always rant on to me about the Paddingtons. I didn't know anything about the fucking Paddingtons. And I showed up, and they used to do these Rhythm Factory bills, and there was six, seven, eight bands on. And I walked in, and I was drinking around that time. You know, I'd relapsed, and I was drinking for a couple of years, but probably because I was managing the fucking Libertines. And I walked in, and you, Tom, you reminded me of Johnny Rotten. I've never really told you that. You were hanging over the mic, unshaven, like you looked as if you weighed 5 stone, right? Probably still do. And I just thought, and what was that? What was the first single I put out? It was a brilliant single. What was that called?
2021.
Yeah, I loved that. And I thought, you played that. And I think I must have asked you for a demo. And I got a demo. I don't know how the demo happened. I must have asked you. I must have been pissed and asked you for it.
And I remember. It's probably why you signed it, because you were pissed out your head.
I was pissed. Right? But I didn't sign you on the spot, though, did I?
No. I think you kind of. You did. You asked me for a demo, and then, you know, a few weeks down the line or whatever. You'd listen to the demo enough and you wanted to release the actual demo and we ended up recording it.
Yeah. It was a great first. You need some fucking stonker songs. And that was it. I was probably just taken with the fact that you were obviously a kind of real rock and roll kid. And the songs, a couple of the songs I loved. I really loved a couple of songs. That first single was fucking great. And it just developed for there, really, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was good. And then we went on to. I was going to ask you because you mentioned Owen Morris a minute ago.
He's a genius. I mean, I laugh and take the piss, but I actually utterly respect him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
He's really, really difficult to work with, you know. But I think he's a fucking genius. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course he is. Yeah, we had Kyle from The View. He told a couple of stories about him as well. We just saying he was a complete madman, but very good at what, and he knew what he wanted. Very good. Have you got?
There's a million Owen Morris stories, but I'll give you one. It's not really particularly rock and roll, but it shows you how mental he is. He was doing my wife's band, which was called Client. No, it wasn't even called Client. Fuck knows what they were called. It was They were called Technique. It was before they put out an album on Poptones, and then eventually they got to change their name and made records on Mute. Or it's called Client. But the Technique record was produced by Owen Morris, right? And right. I facilitated Owen Morris becoming a multimillionaire by the Oasis thing and making sure he got paid and blah, blah, blah. I had a great deal with us and he got made millions, right, basically, right? Anyway, so I thought, like, he was great at electronic pop, which my wife's band, Kate's band, was. So I thought, let's get Owen to do my wife's band. But he was so mental he basically banned me from the studio. That, you know, I was putting the record out, boys, right, on Pop Tones, right? It was my wife, and he banned me for the studio. I don't know if anybody outside music would understand why that's fucking mental, but the guy that's paying for it is banned. The woman that wrote all the songs, husband, is me again. He's banned. And we got on. We got fucking on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's probably
that was Owen.
Yeah, you've got over a million stories about him. He is funny.
I probably have. I never think about him. I mean, I know a lot of stories I can't tell you. The best person for Owen Morris stories is Ray Mead, who plays bass for Jerry Cinnamon in Ocean Colour Scene and made a solo record. But he's one of Owen's best mates, and he told me a couple of fucking stories that Owen would get arrested for, so I can't tell, you know. They're fucking so over the top that it's just like, he's fucking mental. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
Good laugh.
See, I knew he was crazy. By the time that you... See, I had done the Oasis thing and it was he was always mental in these scenarios, right? And he got so mental, I think Noel just decided to stop working with him. Do you know what I mean? And then I'd had the experience with when he's producing my missus, and he banned me for the studio. So I was never going to hire him again. And then you lot, basically, because your manager managed him, suddenly went, "Oh, let's get Owen Morris to produce the pads." And I was like, "I think, do you not remember?" I was like, "Fucking don't do this." And he gave you up. Who was it that took it? Little Martin. Marvin, he did he not have a fucking nervous breakdown during that?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Lost his head for a bit. A couple of us had to escape the studio for a week or whatever, or a few days.
See, the thing is, I know what he's like, Owen. He would look at it and think, they're just a bunch of fucking weaklings. I'm going to break them, and if I don't break them, I'm going to respect them. That's what he's like.
Yeah, and he did. In the end, he was like, yeah, all right. You lot are all right in the end. But, yeah, there was a couple of moments where Grant went home for a few days. I think Marv smashed a few windows, stuff like that. But, yeah, it was good. It was good times, though. All good memories for me.
God, there you go. He's a fucking maniac. But you know what? Somebody like Ray... We and him done a radio show and we were reciting Owen Morris stories. Most of the best ones we couldn't tell. They were all when the records were playing. And he was triggering me to go, "Oh, I remember he'd done this, I remember he'd done that," you know. But he's got better ones than me. Ray Mead's got, you should get him on your show. I mean, fucking hell, man. That kid's got the stories, you know.
So your experience in music, Alan, like... The noughties scene, like, do you think it was unique in any way compared to any other period for guitar bands?
It probably was, guys, but it's, do you know what I mean? I mean, as you got to understand, I came through punk rock.
Yeah.
To me, there's nothing ever going to be bigger than that for me, because when punk was happening, I was 15, and I went to see The Clash and the Buzzcocks and Joy Division, and do you know what I mean? All these bands. And so I suppose nothing's ever going to really, you know, be as good as that for me. The naughty thing was the last time that, you know, rock and roll bands were getting dragged through, wasn't it? I mean, now, you know, it's just not, you know, there is a new breed of bands coming through, like Idols and Shame and, Fontaines. But it's just, it's a different kind of thing again. That was just brutal rock and roll bands, like You Lot, Libertines, Hives, White Stripes, Strokes. It was a moment, really, wasn't it? You know what I mean? That was a good time. When you recite all the bands, Kills, that's another band I managed at the time. But it's like...
Oh, yeah.
Kills, they were good. But it's like...
They were excellent.
And D4, I had them as well. I mean, I had a lot of bands, didn't I? Do you know what I mean?
You've touched on it already, but obviously you were managing the Libertines, and I read everyone kept telling you that you were the man for the job and that you weren't too sure about it.
Do you know what? I don't even know if I ever should have done it, but I sort of did do it, so I suppose I've just got to embrace it. But You know, even now I'm like, did you know I'd really done that? You know what I mean? I was having quite a nice time up till I met the Libertines. Band of fucking maniacs, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the stories about that second album sound mad, that you had to hire two bouncers to separate them and stuff.
Did you meet them? Tom, did you ever meet the two bouncers? The big dudes for
Yeah,
Oxford,
I did, yeah. They were brothers. They were twins.
I'm mates with them still, these guys. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they were proper nice guys, though, as well.
Oh, they're good guys. They're punks. Yeah, yeah. They're, I mean, they're, as much as, like, they're 6'6", fucking... You know, like beyond hard guys. Do you know what I mean? They're like fucking girls, really. But you know, they were punk rockers. You know, they're crass fans. These guys.
Yeah, they were good lads. I like them. Big guys as well.
Yeah, mad guys.
So yeah, tell us about that then. How did we get them?
I didn't really get them. I mean, it was like everybody thinks it was me. It was a guy I was partners with, Stephen, that he knew them. But it was a good call because it was like Libertines were just so fucking mental that, you know, you did have to have proper security around them. Do you know what I mean?
I also saw that you said one of your only big true regrets was not being able to get the best out of Pete Doherty. Is that something that you still feel?
I mean, that's just me. I mean, I just don't think Libertines, early Libertines records are brilliant, you know, plus two records, but... You know, I think he's an amazing talent. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, he just sort of didn't really pay attention with the partying aspect of it. But I think the guy's immensely talented, you know what I mean, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't actually want to do it. I didn't want to manage them. And as you can tell, I'm still going, I wonder if I should have done it. But it's like, I definitely didn't want to in the beginning. And then I heard that What Katie Did, that song, is a demo. And it was a Baby Shambles demo. And that was a song that kind of interested me. Because initially, when he contacted me, it was Peter that initially contacted me and phoned me up and said, do you want to manage the Baby Shambles? And the Baby Shambles hadn't even played a gig at this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, do you know what? I think we got a hell of a lot out of Pete, especially with the Baby Shambles stuff as well. Because that for me was as good as Libertines in a way. Like, obviously, the first Libertines record was like phenomenal, and it kind of, you know, that was like one of my favorite things to, you know, it was one of the first albums to get me really excited, apart from Is This It, when the Strokes brought it out. But, you know, after when the Libertines split or whatever, and they had that the period where they were separated and Shambles were in, like, Shambles were just amazing, just as good, I thought, like, a bit different and like more. You know, it was just, obviously it was just Pete, but yeah, I thought like Pete brought a lot of stuff out, and thought, what else did you get out of him?
I think that record, Fuck Forever, is one of the great rock and roll records. It's as good as anything that anybody's done. Do you know what I mean? And that's as good as when Nirvana were on, and Nirvana were fucking good, weren't they? It was as good as a Nirvana song or something like that. That song was incredible. So I think you're actually right. I think, you know what? He has done a lot of good stuff. I just, something in Doherty, I just thought that there was a massive, massive album in him. But I think just the partying aspect, do you know what I mean? I think it probably sent it left at the lights.
Do you know what as well? It might have been one of those things where, you know, maybe people wouldn't have loved him as much as they do. Like, he might have not been as much of an icon if he went mainstream. Or because, you know, if they'd have gone mainstream, like, I'd have probably not have liked him as much for some reason. Do you know what I mean?
I also read, Alan, that you were the one to give Pete the news of that he was going to go to prison. Like you said, you were the first person to tell him that. Did you feel like a responsibility to be, you know, the honest bloke with him who's going to tell him straight, kind of thing?
Well, I had nothing to lose when I told him that, because I wasn't his manager. And Rough Trade had sent me down to meet him at his sister's place and in Catford. And he'd missed three meetings with a probation officer. And I've never been to prison, but I know enough to know that if you don't meet the probation officer three times, you're probably going to go down. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, And I said to him, I said, I think you're going to go down, dude. And he went, I don't fucking care. And he obviously didn't, you know, because he went down, you know.
And there's obviously that mad story about where you had them over to your house and Carl ended up having a fight with the sink.
Oh, yeah, that was fucking mental. Well, how I'll tell you how I broke the band. It's a bit of a convoluted story, but I didn't actually want to manage them. Went to see the Baby Shambles. Went to America. And they'd fallen out because Peter had burgled Carol Barat's flat. I was in America working with Joaquin Phoenix at the time, who was pretty big, but he wasn't as big as he is now, which is like arguably the biggest actor. But he was big. And he'd done Walk the Line. And I was doing music with him and Anthony Langdon. And we were in the studio in New York, and I got a call to come back. And Rough Trade wanted me to manage Peter, well, manage Libertines. And I was James Endicott, and I was going, no, I don't want to do it. And I ended up coming back. Peter got out, blah, blah, blah. And I got back about a week later. And I went to the Landmark Hotel, and they were like, you know, they just charmed me, guys. I mean, I didn't actually really want to do it. But they were so charming that I ended up being the manager, and I went to Wales on the first day that I managed them. I took them on down there, and it was lovely and everything. But they were that kind of pissed off with each other, and it was like, you know, but it was still a nice kind of time. We were getting them together, and then about four nights in. I just went to bed. I think it was the Wednesday night. And then I woke up and there was, I saw somebody was coming down the stairs at 10 in the morning. I was on the phone to the creation office and the management office. And I turned around out of peripheral vision to my right, and Carol Barat, it looked as if he put like a red sauce over his head, except his eye was hanging out, you know, on the optical nerve. And I was a bit freaked out. I was fucking twitching, and I went and got a baby wipe and pushed Carol Barat's eye back into his head and held it. And I ended up going down to a hospital, and then I Brecon, and they said, this is too serious. He's going to lose his eye. You've got to go to Hereford Hospital. And I went and trekked all the way over another 30, 40 miles to Hereford Hospital to the eye people. And eventually got into see the surgeon. And then they looked at me and Carol Barat, and they said to me, what have you done to your boyfriend? And I was like, he's not my boyfriend, I'm his manager. Carol luckily went, he is only my manager, we're all right. And we saved his eye. And this is me managing the band for 3 days. Unbeknownst to me, we didn't find it out for about another 24 hours. They'd sewn the eye in the wrong way. You know, it wasn't perfectly put back in. So I then had to take him to hospital in London, the Portland Hospital, and it cost me $8,000 to get Carol's eye sorted out and put back in properly. And that was the beginning of me and the Libertines. and when I started managing them, I also put 3 town and country clubs on sale, because I knew on that libertines.org website there was probably, I thought, 5,000 to 10,000 absolute lunatic fans like you, Tom, basically, who would travel to the town and country club and probably buy all three nights of tickets, because this was the most celebrated underground band in Britain. So I'd done that, and we sold 6,000 tickets, and that was 3 sold out town and countries, which was fucking great, you know, because yeah, they'd never played anywhere at that point bigger than, I'm told, the ICA. Do you know what I mean? So we'd done the 3 shows, we'd not put any music out, and I immediately put, you know, for the beginning of April, this was in December, and I just sold 3 Libertines in town country. I put 3 Brixton Academies on sale, And at that point, Rough Trade were just going, you're a fucking maniac, right? You're going to fall on your face. On the Friday that the gig started, we sold the final ticket for the Sunday night, and we had 3 sold-out Brixton Academy shows. And then my next move was we took Can't Stand Me Now to radio, and we got on the list, and that was it. Because basically, it was smoke and mirrors. I don't think there was more than 15,000 Libertines fans when we sold out the 15,000 tickets. Every fan bought a fucking ticket. And then it looked massive, and then radio went there, and then we sold 1 million records. You know what I mean? The rest is history. They became big.
Yeah. I also read, like, when you said you booked those Brixton gigs, that you're having trouble trying to convince Pete not to put on any Gorilla gigs, and that you put one on the same week, did he, or something?
That's true. He used to do it for the crack money. He used to do Gorilla gigs. Do you remember, Tom, fivers, tenners on the door?
Yeah, we played it, a couple of them.
Right, and tenners in the photo booth at the station, wherever he fucking lived in Hackney, right? I mean, when I got him the flat, when I took over the band, I knew that he was doing these Gorilla gigs. So I got him literally the smallest flat I could find him. I got him it, and he still put fucking gigs on.
People climbing through the windows and that.
Yeah. It was fucking insane, you know what I mean? But anyway, him and Carol, they'd sold 15,000 tickets. They were quite impressed with themselves, right? And Carol was just going along with it, because I don't think Carol was particularly about the Gorilla gigs. He just was going along with Peter, right? And they'd done a Gorilla gig on the Tuesday before the Friday, right? And Carol came back depressed to me. I went, what's wrong? And he went, we only sold 6 tickets. And like, it was like a fucking Tuesday. And I said, who showed up? And he went, Japanese tourists. 6 Japanese tourists showed up to Peter's flat. And they were both pissed off. They never got the money for whatever, you know.
That is fucking brilliant.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the thing about life, it's always more ridiculous. The truth is always more ridiculous than anything, do you know what I mean? And yeah, especially the Libertines. Yeah. I mean, only the Libertines could do a Gorilla gig on a Tuesday lunchtime before the 15,000 tickets of the weekend and get 6 people. That's fucking mental.
I sometimes remember stuff and I'm like, have I just convinced myself? It's kind of hard to believe that I've remembered certain things, do you know what I mean? And it's like, have I just made that up in my head? But like, I know that I haven't. It's just all like these mad stories that I just eventually come out. It's like,
weird. I know.
Hey, you also said, Alan, that you've gone on to have like a good relationship with Carl, and that you felt like quite a bit of a loyalty to him after the Libertines. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, big time. I mean, we just got on. We still get on. Do you know what I mean? You know, and he's a good guy. I think, though, to be honest, guys, the fact I saved his eye, I think me and him are always going to be fucking down with each other. Do you know what I mean? Because it was beyond the Call of Duty that time. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, I saved the eye. And then when it was wrong, I paid for the fucking eye to go back in the head properly. So I think me and him are always going to be all right with each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You mentioned Joaquin Phoenix, because I was going to bring up that story of when you first met him. Because it's quite funny the way him and his mate were playing
either
album, and you like...
There was a girl called Nellie Kim, who was Kirsten Dunst's makeup artist girl, right? She was gorgeous. And she liked me, and she went, oh, McGee, like, your last... We're hanging out and everything, and she went, it's your last day, you know, because I used to be there nearly all the time at this point, right? And she said to me, let's go for food at Toy and Sunset. And I was, which is a Thai restaurant, guys. And I was like, fucking rock and roll. This gorgeous girl wants to take me for fucking food. Of course I'm going to go, right? And we're driving along Sunset. And she goes, Alan, do you mind if I take you up to meet some of my actor friends? And I was thinking, for fuck's sake. And I was like, no, not at all. And then suddenly, right on up the hill. And the actor friends of, like, you know, these two guys, you know, like we get to this humble house And there's a studio set up in the house, and these two guys, who I don't have a fucking clue who they are, right? And, you know, and this English guy goes, oh, you know, hello, you know, I met you with Oasis. And I'm thinking, you never fucking met me, but I'm going to just go along with it, you know, because, oh, yeah, I remember you. But I think, I don't fucking remember you. And I don't think, I think he was just delusional, you know. And I think he must have met Marcus, their manager. So he never met me. But anyway, and this other guy goes, hey, and then I was like, all right, squeaky voice, whatever, right? And then, because it was in a bad mood that I wasn't with a girl, they played me about 20-odd songs, and I just fucking slaughtered every song. I just said, no, this is what you do, but that's what you do. I just annihilated the songs, boys, right? And and they were getting into it, especially the squeaky voice guy that's doing the fucking mixing desk. And at the end of the night, it goes, I'm Anthony Langdon. You know, I was in Space Hog, blah, 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 whatever, Anthony. Nice guy, actually, right? And the other guy goes, hey, I'm Joaquin Phoenix. And I was like, Phoenix? Maybe something to do with River Phoenix. So I got back to I've never cracked on, you know, to her that I didn't have a fucking clue who I'd met. And then I got on Google and I put in River Phoenix. And then I looked and his sibling was Joaquin. And I went, oh, it's River Phoenix's brother. And, it transpired about a week later, Joaquin phoned me up, and he's a Britpop fan, a big Oasis fan, and he went, I want you to produce my album. And I went, I'm not a producer, I'm a manager. And he went, no, he goes, we know you're a producer, you know, you know, we know that, you know, you'll get it, we want you to. And I ended up kind of in the studio with him for about 6 months. It was good, you know.
You're like, fuck it, why not?
Just look back at the Hives, Alan. Like you say, they were one of the first bands that you signed on, Pop Turns.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that you kind of got hold of them and you saw they had two albums that were already out. And you kind of, you decided to pick the best of those two and forward.
I'll tell you what happened, guys. It was like, I'd started Pop Turns and I was doing a promo tour of Germany, doing all the fucking TV shows and all that sort of bullshit, because it was coming off the back of Oasis. So everybody was like, what's he going to do next? And it was about 1:30 in the morning, and I put on Bravo or something like that. And it wasn't even Bravo 1 where the pop hits, it was Bravo 2. We're looking at the fucking snide indie bands, right? And it was all because there was nothing on the fucking TV, right? And it was like, it was all these shite indie bands, and it was like, oh, fuck's sake. Suddenly, Hate to Say I Told You So comes on, the full complete video. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Eating my fucking chocolates, right? On the bed. And I'm like, fuck. So the next day I phoned up the office and I went, the Hives. And I went, we'll find out. So they phoned up and went, they're on a record company called Burning Heart. And they're about to get dropped. And I went, really? And they went, they've had two albums out. The second album's come out. And the worldwide sales we've checked is 600 copies. So they had fucking bombed, right? So I said, okay, approach the record company, license the two albums, give them $5,000. I think they actually paid $2,000 as it goes, right? But offer them $5,000, that's the budget. And what I'll do, if you get them, I'll choose the best songs, but we'll make that Hate to Say I Told You So a hit. We bought it for $2,000, put it together. There was Hate to Say I Told You So, Main Offender, Do or Die, Die All Right. We had four big hits with it. And I've done about 400,000 here and about 1.2 million in America. And they broke.
Yeah, that's
crazy, isn't it? Love that.
It wasn't so much that I was good. It was just they were right. And all I did was identified you're going to happen if I fucking get this right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, he's a hell of a lead singer, ain't that bloke as well? Like, his personality.
Oh, he's amazing. I love Pelly. He's fucking amazing. I talked to him quite a lot. He had COVID. He had it over in Sweden 2 or 3 months ago.
All right. And they're still producing music as well, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They're just a brilliant band. Brilliant.
I also know it's a story about where you got the chance to sign The Darkness, which is quite a funny one.
Well, I tell you what happened. It was like, I got, you know, Ian, who worked for Pop Tones, worked for me, right? He came to me and he went, McGee, I just need you to say yes. And I said, what am I saying yes to? And he went, the Darkness. And I went, okay, who are the Darkness? And he went, they're this band. They've got 15 pages coming up in Dazed and Confused. They've got the front page. We just put it out. I guarantee it's going to sell. And here's the song that they've got called, what is it, something called Love, or whatever the fucking hit is, right? Yeah. And I went, a little thing called Love, isn't that a song? Is that Queen? Anyway, some one of these kind of songs. And I put it on, right? And it was for 25 seconds. It was like AC/DC. And I thought, this is good, right? This is fucking good. And then suddenly Justin Hawkins comes in and goes, Julie, call Love. Right? And I was like, fucking hell. And I was thinking, Ian's right. It's probably going to sell. But I don't know. I mean, I found the Mary Chain, Oasis. I found all these fucking amazing bands. Can I really do the Darkness? It seems a bit of a joke to me. So I phoned Gillespie up and I went, I wanted to play you something. Tell me what you think. So it was like AC/DC, so he was quiet. And then when the boys came in, he went, whoa, that. He laughed and I went, fuck that, I can't put it out. So we never put it out. And then it sold 4 million. And do you know what, boys? I should have put it out. That's the truth. I should have just taken the money.
I love Bobby Gillespie just laughing.
He was
on
like,
the front.
He laughed when the guy started singing. And I thought, I can't do it. Because at that point, this is 20 years ago, I mean, I had such a run of fucking amazing bands. I hadn't even got to Libertines at that point. And I just thought, I can't fucking spoil the fucking the line of greatness that I'm fucking ploughing at the moment. You know what I mean? You know?
I guess with that in mind, Alan, is there anything you would have done differently about that Noughties period, apart from signing the Darkness?
I wish I'd signed Arctic fucking Monkeys. I know. I mean... How did I not get the Arctic Monkeys? Because I had all the other good bands. How did I end up not getting them? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know how that happened. I don't know. It's like...
Yeah, that would have been special.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know how that didn't happen, but it didn't, you know.
And then, yeah, I mean, in your book you say in 2008 you'd had your fill of music, or working in music, sorry. And obviously now you're involved again there. What caused that change?
I think I wrote the book and then everybody asked me to become the manager again.
Right.
And you know what I mean? It was like, and I'd always been mates with Sean and Bez. They didn't have a manager. They asked me, Mary Chain asked me, Wilco Johnson asked me, Cast asked me. And before I knew it, I was managing a few bands again, you know. I don't manage that many bands now, though. I've got Glass Vegas, Cast, Happy Mondays, Black Great. So I'm only managing 4 bands, you know.
Yeah, and you mentioned you're working with like younger bands now. Like, yeah. How does that differ from the Noughties period or any other period with the guitar bands? Like, what are the challenges
it's
for them
it's
now?
It's much, much more DIY. I mean, I'm literally one guy running an entire label now. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So,
yeah.
And you can do it. Do you know what I mean? You can actually do that. Whereas you could never have done that back in the day, could you? Do you know what I mean? But now I've now run Creation 23 and I run it myself and I put the records out and blah, blah, blah. And I have got people that help me with the promotion, you know, at radio and press. But essentially it's one guy running a record label. Never do that in the 80s or the 90s. Not. Do you know what I mean? You would have had to have a few people helping you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like even Pop Tones, I remember all like Jody and was it Wolfie, that guy?
Yeah, Wolfie.
Yeah, all them lot. Like, you know, there was a lot. We always had quite a strong team, obviously, behind all of that. And yeah, it's got to be. I mean, not that you do you need as much of that these days, but.
Well, you
obviously
need.
I've got a radio.
You know, you probably know the person that's doing it, Tom. Danny Watson. You know the guy who used to DJ with at Death Disco. The fat guy.
Yeah.
Well, Danny's one of my best mates, and Danny's become a radio plugger, so he plugs all my bands. And then I've got a guy, Rob Sonic Kertford at Sonic PR. does the press, and Danny does the streaming for me now as well, does Spotify for me. So,
no.
But they're like people that are hired in just to do that. But the actual main thing about the label is me, and it's crazy now that you can run it off a fucking telephone. You know what I mean?
But is it more difficult for young bands to sustain its success without that kind of?
I think it's just difficult for young bands, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You know, it's difficult, but it'll probably come round again. It'll probably become a bit bands eventually. It'll change, you know what I mean?
Can you tell us a story about when your wife looked at your browsing history after you've been clicking at random? The one way about your wife, where she looked at your browsing history on the internet when you'd been randomly clicking at shit online.
Oh, right. No, but it wasn't... No. Was that when I first got a computer?
Yeah.
Oh, right. It was actually pretty innocent, Tom. But maybe it was such a fucking... But it was such a weird time. Because it's like... So she left me. This is about 1996, right? The height of Britpop. And I just worked out what the internet was, and maybe 1997. And she went out and left me. And I was on the computer, and there was a fucking advert, a porny advert on AOL or whatever it was that I was on, right? And I started going, oh, what's that? Click, and it fucking froze. And I didn't have a clue about computers. And it was just a big pair of tits. And I was like, it was like advertising some porn site. And I clicked. I didn't even get to the porn site. And it was just... Basically, so I was like fucking sweating, right? God, she's going to think I'm a pervert, right? And then she came in and looked at me, I mean, oh my God's sake. And then basically restarted the computer. But I was like, I was fucking mortified, you know what I mean?
Brilliant. I love it. I need to get that one out.
Oh, it's just life, isn't it, mate? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I could just see you sat there like fucking panicking, trying to close everything down.
Because it was back in the day of like 1996, 1997 that, you know, the internet, none of us knew how to really work computers. Do you know what I mean? Literally, she was on the internet for about a year before me, and she used to talk to the internet, and I was just going, it's fucking rubbish. And then she got me one night to put this in, and I was like, that's lies. And then I was looking at her computer for about an hour. And then she goes, that's the internet. I went, really? You know, no clue, bro.
Excellent.
Alan, we usually ask guests for if they've got a good story about, you know, some of the big names of that time. I appreciate you giving us quite a few already, but is there any others that stand out?
I don't know. Who about in particular?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. Have you got like a story about somebody like some massive... Like a huge pop star or rock star.
I'll give you one about the Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair. But what one would I give you? Right, so I was giving money to the Labour Party. This is about 98, 99, right? And Cherie Blair, who thought I was great, invited me and Paul Smith, right, to take her to London Fashion Week. And I think it was like September 1999, right? That's what it was, right? And I had given hundreds of thousands of pounds to the Labour Party, right? So anyway, I didn't give a fuck about going to the fucking Fashion Week with Cherie Blair. I couldn't give a fuck. But so I was never going to go. And the invite was on the mantelpiece. And my wife, like all women, love all that. And she went, I want to go to that. And I went, yeah, just phone up Margaret McDonough, who was the General Secretary of the Labour Party. Phone Margaret up and get an invite. So the Labour Party in true fucking procrastination fucking, you know, like mode, basically left it. We were supposed to go to the Monday to the fucking to the Fashion Week, and it got to the Friday, and then the Labour Party phoned us and went, Kate can't come, my missus can't come. So of course I then went, well, fuck that shit, I ain't gonna go. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't care anyway. I was never really going to go. I was only going because basically you know, Kate was going, I want to go to that. And I was like, okay, I'll go. But I didn't never wanted to go. So anyway, she phoned up the Labour Party and basically threatened them and went, don't fucking ever ask for any more money off of him. She saw it as they were disrespecting us or her, whatever, however women respected it. She was like, going, no more fucking money to you cunts, basically, right? So basically, we got an invite to Chequers about the next month. Within a week, we'd have been invited to Chequers for Saturday night dinner with Tony and Cherie, right? So we drive on down in the fucking limo. I was driven around at this point, Tom, by a fucking, I think it was Mark, a West Ham football hooligan that lived in Eltham, right? The fucking head came. But anyway, he drove me. I used to hire cars for this limo company, and I got driven down to the fucking Prime Minister. And at the fucking dinner, well, anyway, I'll tell you, I've got to run it through it because you'll like some of this, right? So anyway, about 25 past seven, I'm outside Chequers in a car, in a pub car park. And then it fucking goes to 31 minutes past seven and I'm coming out the car at Chequers and Mark, the football hooligan, goes around to the fucking kitchen where the other fucking drivers are about to fucking arrive, right? You know, they get a cup of tea or whatever, right? And I go on in and there's Tony Blair dressed in Gap fucking clothes, right? I'm in a Paul Smith suit, right? Looking rather Britpop, I suppose, right? And my missus is all done up in Prada and all that bollocks. And Tony Blair's in his Gap Originals. Anyway, after about 5-10 minutes talking about the new Oasis record, which was coming out, I don't think it came out for another six months or something like that, you know, or maybe even a bit longer. I think I was playing him Go Let It Out or something, whatever, anyway. And at a certain point, we get to the fucking door and suddenly all you hear is, now then, now then, now then. And we turn round, and it's fucking Jimmy Savile in a tracksuit, right? And we're like, and you got to understand, Jimmy Savile in 1999 hadn't been famous for 15 fucking years. So I was like, what the... I looked at Tony Blair and I went, it's just got fucking too weird, right? Because I'm standing talking to the Prime Minister and Jimmy Savile has walked in, right? And then Jimmy Savile's fucking Jimmy Savile and he's just... at that point... He wasn't known as a fucking... Well, I didn't honestly know that he was known as a nonce or anything like that. You know, I had no clue. And at the dinner table, he was fucking weird and wonderful and fucking sleazy with my missus. You know, I never saw that. She tells me that. I believe her. And it was just fucking... It was just one of the most surreal fucking... He came with a... a guy, a security guy... That ran a security firm with 2,500 people. So he was totally fucking. He was connected, mate. Do you know what I mean? You know. So that was a strange time, you know.
Yeah, strange bunch of people all in one place.
Yeah, it was me and my missus. This is who was there. It was me and my missus, Tony and Cherie, John Reid, the Celtic director. It was also the foreign secretary at one point. John O'Farrell wrote Things Can Only Get Better book and his wife, who's that fucking actress? Dame Edna, you know, I can't remember people's names sometimes. Who's in the Bond movie, the old woman?
Judy Dench,
Dame Judy Dench and her husband Michael something, Jimmy Savile and a security guy and the guy that controls the nuclear button. Some general, right? He was there as well.
And it was like the start of a joke or something.
Yeah, that's the most fucking surreal fucking group of people. Do you know what I mean?
Just remember.
Can I just say one thing, boys? Who the fuck is interested in this shit? Do you know what I mean?
You'd be surprised, mate. I think.
All right.
Just one last one. I just remembered one story from your book, Alan, where talk about. Being on the same plane as Michael Jackson and he started giggling at you or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've met him a couple of times. I met him in Tokyo. I got taken backstage by Sony And when I get really nervous, I get really Scottish. and he couldn't understand anything I said, which was funny. And he was tall as fuck. This would be September 1992. That's when it was. And or maybe October 1992. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Michael Jackson was playing eight nights at the Tokyo Dome, 50,000 people a night, this massive fucking arena in Tokyo. And then the next time I met him, I was on Concord, and I got on, and somebody, it was nobody, it was the 11th, I think, I don't know why I remember dates, it was the 11th of January, 1997, it was about 5 years later, and me and Ed Ball had just went over, and we were just coming back to New York, and we're just coming back, and as we got on the plane, the woman looked at us, and she went, "Are you with Michael?" And we went, "Yes." Just taking the piss. We didn't have a fucking clue who Michael was. But we just thought, yeah, we're with Michael. And we went, oh, no. And it was Michael Jackson sitting with a COVID-19 fucking mask. And it was very strange. I mean, it wasn't cool. It was like two managers, two bouncers, Michael Jackson, and then a kid, about 15, that was dressed like Michael Jackson, exactly like Michael Jackson, with the mask on as well. It was fucking strange, do you know what I mean, you know?
So yeah, what, you got on the... Did you sit next to him?
No. We went up, and because I was bald, and Ed Ball, who was over there with me, I don't know if you remember Ed Ball, I put out some singles and albums by him, but he was dressing like me at the time. He was bald in Paul Smith suits. And Michael Jackson saw two bald guys coming up and started laughing. And I was like, to Ed's a fucking Chelsea football hooligan. And Ed was like, I'm fucking going to go up there, McGee. And he was really, and I'm like, you'll get your legs broken by the security. Fucking shut up, you know. That's what happened.
Fucking hell. That's superb.
Now fight your fallen boys. Now I'm just fucking locked on my own in fucking Tower of London, just fucking trying to avoid the COVID, you know?